Okay, so let me remind you where we are. We discussed last time that what Einstein was looking for was an equation in which some tensor constructed out of G and derivatives of G and maybe second derivatives of G was going to be equal to 8 pi G T mu nu over C to the fourth. And what we require is that this tensor reduce to x naught naught should reduce to minus grad squared h naught naught in the Newtonian limit. In order that we reproduce Poisson's equation, and therefore we reproduce all the results of Newtonian gravity. So then we argued that the only possibilities for x were the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar times g mu nu, but we had to take them in a particular combination. R mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu r, which by definition is the Einstein tensor, because this obeys d mu g mu nu equals 0, and which is necessary for the consistency of star this equation. If this equation is going to be consistent with d mu t mu nu equals 0. So what we want to happen is that stress energy is conserved. In this theory, certainly if I go to a locally inertial coordinate system in locally flat coordinates, I should find T mu nu is the usual description of matter, special relativistic matter, so particles, fields, and so on. And we're pretty sure that energy and momentum must be conserved, so this equation has to be valid. Now, actually, somebody asked a great question at the end of the last lecture. I think I'll just have a little diversion to explain it. You see, I was arguing last time that the only possibility for a non-trivial action for gravity was this. So this is the scalar volume element, and R is the Ricci scalar. And somebody asked me, well, that's a little bit funny because the Ricci scalar involves two derivatives of the metric, right? Not one. So normally when we think of an action, it involves single time derivatives squared, right? So for example, so this involves two time derivatives. So let's say, sorry, second order, this contains d naught squared g. It contains second time derivatives of the metric. So normally when we have an action, you know, we write it, let's say, in this way for a particle, including single time derivative squared. And that's actually very important because when you vary this action, the surface term, what I want to be true is that the variation of this action is equal, for all, equals zero for all delta x implies mx double dot equals zero, for example, right? I want that to be true. And when I say for all delta x, what I mean is for all delta x satisfying the boundary conditions. what are the boundary conditions? Well, usually we say the let's think of this particle following some path. Here's x of t, and we fix x initial and x final, and we vary the path, right? But we don't vary these things. These are the boundary conditions. So that's where you define a variational principle. You have to specify the boundary conditions, and then you consider all paths satisfying the boundary conditions. So in particular, it means delta x equals 0 at t initial and t final. That's what the boundary conditions are. So if somebody gave you an action, well, you see, when we do this calculation, we vary it. We get integral m x dot delta x dot, right? And what do? I integrate by parts. So I write this as m x dot delta x minus integral m x double dot delta x. And then I say, well, this is 0 at initial and final because delta x is 0 initial and final. And so this is 0. And this must be 0 for all delta x. Therefore, the equation of motion is satisfied. But notice it's actually quite important that this only involves first time derivatives. Okay. If I gave you an action, which was mx double dot dot x dt, all right, and you varied it, you're going to get a term in the surface integral, which is delta x dot, right? Because I'll vary this delta x double dot, I'll integrate by parts, I'll get a surface term involving delta x dot. Boundary conditions don't tell you that that is 0. There's no reason for delta x dot to be 0. When you vary this path, obviously the velocity changes as you vary the path, okay? So this is a bad action. It just doesn't give the equations of motion subject to the boundary conditions. Okay, now unfortunately, it's the same for this action, right? Because it involves two time derivatives of the metric. So what do you do about that? And there's a very interesting resolution. You see, if I gave you this action, you'd say, oh, well, that's a lousy action. So let me integrate it by parts, all right? I mean, I presume I'd have to give you this action. And then I'd integrate by parts and dt. And I'll throw away the boundary term, because that was the bad term. That's what messed up my variational principle. Okay, so it's clear what to do. You have to integrate by parts. And so if you look in Dirac's book on gravity, he did this, and so what you do is you take this integral and you integrate by parts just to reduce it to single time derivatives, okay? And then it's a good action. And then you say, in the case of gravity, I fix the initial metric. So you fix the 3 metric on some space-like slice, for example, my Gij, that's fixed, in some coordinate system. Then I have my 4 metric, and so this is initial, and that's final. I fix that as well, Gij fixed. And I vary all possible spacetimes in between, okay? And that's the variational principle for Gr. But it requires that you integrate by parts in this action. Now, the problem is when you integrate by parts, you get something which is not general coordinate invariant. Okay, this is the only general coordinate invariant local density. Obviously, you mess around with it, it's not going to be, and throw things away, it's not going to be coordinate invariant. What do you say about that? Well, the resolution is you had to pick a time, right, to define a variational principle in this sense. You had to choose a time. As soon as you choose a time, you've broken coordinate invariance. So, you know, tough. somehow the laws of physics, the way they're formulated, don't like us to pick a particular time. we do it in order to calculate, in order to make predictions, blah, blah, blah. But we know there are infinite number of possible times. And we know this. Every elementary particle, every clock, every object has its own time. We learned that from relativity. So you've no business picking a particular time. Right? So a lot of sometimes people get very confused about this. There are many books written that there is no time in GR, blah, blah, blah. I don't think it's that there's no time. There's an infinite number of possible times, and choosing any one of them is an arbitrary choice. And when you do need to do it to define the dynamics of the theory. But once you've chosen that time, you have messed up coordinate invariance. Okay, so it's sort of a bind that we're in. No. Oh, sorry, linear. Yes, it is. It is. Yes, it's linear in the second derivatives. No, true. But this is also linear in the second derivatives. It's not a good action. Good action is one whose variation vanishes whose total variation vanishes when I impose the boundary conditions and when I impose the equations of motion. And that is not true of this action. Okay, sorry, that was a little aside, but great question, and I have lots of great questions. Actually, I wanted to thank you all for your feedback, because I got the feedback yesterday on the course. It's very helpful to know what I'm doing wrong, especially. So thank you for that. Okay, where are we? Go back to this. So I just summarized what we did yesterday. So now we're going to use a kind of tricky argument to determine the coefficient of the Einstein tensor, the constant of proportionality here. That's what I want to do. And we'll find that it's 1, but we'll have to go through a little bit of a tricky argument. So the question, what is r naught naught minus 1/2 g naught naught r? See, clearly we want to take the naught naught component of this equation with the assumption that this stress tensor is non-relativistic. It's low velocities, low pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And this, the left-hand side is we know is proportional to this guy. In the Newtonian limit. Assuming the Einstein equation, okay, which we don't yet know. Okay. So we're going to assume it anyway. We're going to assume there is a constant here, which we don't know. But we're going to use that fact to determine what this quantity is in the following way. So the look at the IJ equations. Which read Rij minus 1/2 Gij, R is proportional to Tij. Okay, we don't yet know the proportionality constant, but whatever it is, this is what the Einstein equations tell us. And then this we know is much less than T naught naught in the Newtonian limit. Why? Because all velocities are small. If you remember the stress energy for a particle, T mu nu for a particle is proportional to U mu U nu, where U is the four velocity of the particle. And there's a delta function and so on and so forth. But the space components of the four velocity are much less than the time components if the velocities are small, right? Because the space components are dxi d tau, the time components is dt d tau. So tij is much less than t0, 0 if dxi d tau is much less than dt d tau, i.e. dxi d tau much less than c, and I've got a c in here. dt, sorry, this is dt. Okay, so that's generally true. In the Newtonian limit, we can assume the spatial stresses are much smaller than the energy density. This part is called a spatial stress. This is the energy density. And that means the right-hand side of the equation is relatively small. And so that means that Rij is approximately 1/2 delta Ijr. Okay, so if I can neglect the right-hand side of the equation, the only way for this equation to work is that these two terms balance. They might both be 0, too, or they might both be larger than this, and they might cancel. I mean, those are the only possibilities. But now this tells you that the Ricci scalar, which is minus R00 plus RKK. So what I'm using here, this is only approximate. Recall that the Riemann curvature goes like the derivative of second derivatives of H. And we're allowed to replace, in any coefficient, the metric with eta, right? We're only working to first order. So when I work out the Ricci scalar, mu nu, is the Riemann tensor rho, this is rho whatever, lambda, sigma, delta. So this would be rho mu sigma nu. In fact, let me write it this way. Mu, yeah, the Riemann tensor with all lowered indices is second derivatives of H. The Ricci tensor would have a contraction with the metric. Okay, but this metric, this inverse metric, is basically eta plus H. Now, this is already of order H. So when I compute the inverse metric, I can just use the eta. Okay, and likewise, the Ricci scalar would be g mu nu r mu nu, but I can just use eta. At first order in H, whenever I see a metric, I can use eta if it's multiplying something already of order h. So that means that the Ricci scalar is equal to this, right? The Ricci scalar is just this contraction of the Ricci tensor. G mu nu is just eta mu nu inverse. Then this is minus 1 and plus 1 in the space components. And so now from this equation, I know RKK, right, means sum over the spatial indices. So RKK is 3/2 R, where R is the full Ricci scalar. So this is plus 3/2 R. And so now we determine that 1/2 R equals R 0, 0. So R is equal to 2 R00. Okay, so it's a kind of clever argument. You use some equations you didn't know. You don't know. You still don't know. But you use them in order to relate these these two unknown these two quantities, the R and the R00. And so G00 is equal to R00 plus 1/2, which should be minus, plus 1/2 R. Again, you see, when I write down this formula, this G00 is really eta 00 plus h, but I'm only working to first order in h. So I can drop the eta term in here, just replace it with eta. Drop the h term, replace this with eta. Okay, so G00 is eta 00 plus h 00. We can drop this because we're already multiplying something of order h. And so now we know that this is equal to so R is two R zero zero, so this is two R zero zero. Okay, good. So we've figured out everything in terms of just one quantity. We need to know R00 to first order in H. So let's start from the Riemann tensor, sigma rho mu nu. This is 1/2 H nu rho, H nu sigma rho mu minus H rho nu comma sigma mu minus H mu sigma comma rho nu plus H rho mu comma sigma nu plus order h squared. And so it follows, you see, to get the Ricci tensor 0, 0 components, I'm obviously going to use this equation, right? So I need to know the Riemann tensor. The mu and nu are 0 and 0. I need to know the Riemann tensor. G is eta. And so I need to know the Riemann tensor's 0, 0 component, 0, 0, 0, 0, and I need I, 0, J, 0. Okay, so let's first of all work out the Riemann tensor 0, 0, 0, 0. Well, what's that? That's obviously 0. We know that anyway, because this is antisymmetric on the two, any pair of indices, the first or the second pair of indices. So, and it's true. According to this formula. So we know that that is 0. So now let's work out the other piece, the spatial piece, which contributes to the Ricci tensor, 0, 0 component. And so now I'm going to ignore time derivatives. Okay, so sigma is I, rho is j, and I hope I wrote that down right. Where's I, rho is j. I don't think I kind of written that down right. sorry, said it wrong. Sigma is I, mu is j. Okay, sigma is I, mu is j. The only term that involves no time derivatives, okay, everything is zero. So this involves a time derivative, a rho zero derivative. This involves a zero derivative. This involves a zero derivative because nu is zero. So the only term which involves no d zeros is this one. So it's minus 1/2 h zero zero comma sigma is I and mu is j. It's only valid at first order. And now I can compute R 0, 0 just by contracting these two indices. And so this is R0i Well, we don't need to bother raising and lowering in spatial components. And so this is minus 1/2 d squared h 0, 0. But we have from here, let's call that dagger. And so dagger implies that g 0, 0 is equal to minus del squared h 0, 0. And that's exactly what we wanted. Okay, so we know the coefficient is 1. So so that's that. So you can see it's quite intricate. The arguments were quite intricate, and it's not too surprising that people got the equations wrong first time around. Hilbert didn't do any better than Einstein. But at the end of the day, they are absolutely unique, and they don't introduce any new constants or actually, except one, okay? Except one, which I'll talk about now. Before I do that, let's mention another form of the Einstein equations. We can, of course, take the trace of the left and the right-hand side. So just remember, remember g mu nu is r mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu r. Okay, this was the special special combination that is covariantly conserved, d mu g mu nu is 0. But you see, we could equally well say, can I express the Einstein equations as r mu nu equals something? And you can. Just take the trace of this. So g lambda lambda is equal to, so I take the trace of the r mu nu, which is r. The trace of the metric is 4, because g mu nu g mu nu is equal to 4. This is the inverse of that, so you're just taking delta mu nu, summing over the indices. And so this gives r minus 2r, which is minus r. And so by the Einstein equation, this is, of course, 8 pi g over c to the fourth t lambda lambda. And so what I can see is that that r is equal to minus the trace of the stress tensor. So that allows me to just pull this term to the right-hand side of the Einstein equations. So the Einstein equations can also be written as r mu nu equals 8 pi g over c to the fourth, t mu nu minus 1/2 g mu nu t lambda lambda. So those are completely equivalent equations. And this form is useful for gravitational radiation. It just turns out that r mu nu is a bit simpler than g mu nu, actually in certain specific gauges or coordinate systems. And so it's more convenient to use the Einstein equations in the second form. Now let me say about this extra term. If I wanted to modify this equation, what could I do? So I have g mu nu is 8 pi g over c to the fourth t mu nu. The question is there anything I could add which is compatible with sort of general principles? That I want the equations to be second order in time. I don't want higher derivatives. I want them to be consistent. I want them to reduce to a Newtonian limit. What could I possibly add to this equation? Right, both of these obey. We have d mu nu is d mu t mu nu equals 0. Okay, so it's consistent as it is. Nevertheless, I can add something. It's a very, very obvious something. What could I add? Just the metric tensor times a constant. Okay, so I could add plus lambda g mu nu, and it's sort of up to you whether you want to put it inside the bracket, you know, view it as a part of the stress tensor, or if you want to put it on the left-hand side and view it as a part of gravity. It's up to you, but you're free to add this constant. And so this is called the cosmological constant. And it doesn't spoil this consistency, of course, because the metric is also okay. In fact, any covariant derivative of the metric is zero, so certainly true. So there's no consistency problem. So it's consistent with stress, with energy momentum conservation. Well, then you say, well, wouldn't I have fouled up this argument with the Newtonian limit? If I did that? Well, not if this is small. Okay, so if this term is small, it doesn't change that conclusion. So you're free to add a relatively small cosmological, it's called a cosmological term. Now, why is it called a cosmological term? Because Einstein added it to make a sensible cosmology, right? The trouble is that Einstein, when he was playing with these things, tried to figure out what, you know, if I assume the universe is full of matter, so I know, I can guess what t mu nu is, some uniformly spread distribution of mass. If I assume that, that was called the cosmological principle. By the way, we call something a principle when we don't understand it. That's when you call it a principle, because you can't justify it. Okay? So it's simply a declaration of ignorance to say something is a principle. But anyway, Einstein invented a couple of principles, many principles, actually. The key is to pick the right principle, that the consequences are then correct. Okay, so one of them was the cosmological principle. So he said, well, I know nothing about the distribution of matter in the universe. And at this time, they didn't even know there was more than one galaxy. Okay, that was only figured out in the late 1920s. So they really knew nothing about the universe. So Einstein said, well, what should I guess? Well, my guess is that the mass is distributed uniformly through space at a, you know, first approximation. So there's galaxies and stars, but probably they just spread uniformly through space. That was called a cosmological principle. Okay, so that gave him a guess as to this t mu nu, and we'll do this next week. We'll solve these equations with such matter. And the problem is that matter gravitates. Okay, so you make this uniform distribution of mass, well, it's all going to attract itself, and the universe is going to collapse in a very short time. So that was a disaster. So he realized his theory predicted a disastrous cosmology. Then he noticed he could add this term. It turns out this term creates a repulsive gravity, that space-time itself wants to expand if you include this term with the plus sign. It's a repulsive effect. It's very bizarre. So he said, oh, great, I have just what I need. I'm going to balance this term and this term, so there'll be some attraction and some repulsion, and the universe will stay still. And that was his first cosmological solution. Of course, it's not too surprising. It was completely unstable, because the mass you can move around. So you can imagine making the mass a little bit more concentrated in one region than another, and then it's going to collapse because it overcomes the vacuum energy. This you can't do anything with, just a constant. Okay, so you can't perturb that at all. And so this universe he made is unstable. It would either collapse or it would blow up to infinity and the mass would all become irrelevant. So those were his first attempts. And famously, he said that was his biggest blunder, was to introduce this term, because otherwise he would have predicted that the universe cannot be static. It has to be either collapsing or expanding. And this was discovered in 1926 or 27 by Hubble. So he said it was his biggest blunder to introduce this term. But Einstein's biggest blunder is something we only dream of doing. And so in the mid-1990s, observations showed that, in fact, that term is there. So even though it doesn't stabilize the universe, it's there, and it is going to dominate the future evolution of the universe. It's already 70% of the energy in the universe is in this guy. Only 30% is in the Timunu. So we will come to this next week. So it is very small. It doesn't affect the Newtonian argument, but it's there. Okay, so actually now is a good time to take a break. So why don't you walk around for 5 minutes and come back.
About the action, mm-hmm. I usually found we needed to add a...
Thank you. What's in
And just repeat what Maxwell did. Maxwell wrote down all these equations, discovered that he discovered light. Okay, what is Einstein doing is just copying Maxwell. Okay? So he's discovered the equations. Oh, I know what I should do. I should see if there are any wave solutions. And if so, that'll be interesting. It's a new physical phenomenon. But honestly, he was just copying Maxwell. The root of everything is Maxwell. Okay, so let's start with Maxwell. And you know, when the Bible says, "Let there be light," they weren't far off the mark. Okay. This indeed was very fundamental. Okay, so solutions. Sorry? What's this? Oh, yeah, not me. Okay. So my voice deteriorated. Actually, I thought it was all of you complaining at the number of indices. Whoa! Okay. So, solutions to the Einstein equations. Well, we need to understand these equations. They're very complicated. because they're nonlinear. Okay, the Riemann tensor is a nonlinear function of G. It involves G, it involves G inverse. And if you solve any practical problem, this is kind of a nightmare. Because if you pick some particular matrix for G, and imagine writing, write down its elements, and then say, what is the inverse? Well, it's 1 over the determinant times the cofactors. You know, that's a non-polynomial expression. I mean, it's a big mess. So these equations are quite complicated. So let's look at Maxwell. Because the issues of principle arise, the same issues of principle arise in the Maxwell equations. So the Maxwell equations tell us that d mu f mu is d mu a nu minus d mu a mu equals minus j nu. Okay? So what I'm doing here, the field strength is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And so I'm just expressing the Maxwell equations in terms of this vector potential a nu. And you can think about a mu is sort of comparable in some way to the metric. The Einstein equations are second-order differential equations for the metric. Maxwell equations are second-order differential equations for the potential, for the vector potential. So now the problem is, if you write down these equations, there's no unique solution. Okay, and that's easy to see. There is the solution is not, let's say it this way. For given J, for given J nu, so J nu is like the T mu nu term in the Einstein equations, and for given J nu, the solution is not unique. The solution for A mu is undetermined. Okay, there is no unique solution for J. Even though Maxwell is a linear theory, this J nu, this current is gauge invariant, there's none of that, the complications in relativity. Nevertheless, this equation doesn't determine A. Okay, and the reason for that is the gauge invariance. Precisely because the left-hand side is gauge invariant, A mu is not gauge invariant, then if I have one solution for A mu, I have an infinite number of solutions to the same physical problem, just related by gauge transformations. And so we frequently encounter this problem. For example, if we Fourier transform with respect to space, space-time, so if I say A mu is a sum of A mu of k e to the I k dot x, this k dot x means eta mu nu. Well, actually, I can just write it as k mu x mu. Then the left-hand side becomes minus k squared delta mu nu. You see d mu d nu is minus k squared. And the delta mu nu will just take an a mu and convert it to an a nu. And then I have the second term is plus k mu k nu. This is equal to j nu. Minus j nu. So by Fourier transforming, you just could convert this differential equation into an algebraic equation. But the trouble is this equation has no solution. Okay, so this matrix, M mu nu, is not invertible. And that's easy to see because it has a zero eigenvector. Which is to say that M mu nu k nu equals zero if k squared equals zero. So I can take any vector which is null, any four vector k. So an example would be, this is a four component vector, right? So if I take this vector and I work out k mu k nu eta mu nu, from the time component I get minus k squared, and from the z component I get plus k squared, and so this is zero. So if a matrix has a zero eigenvector, it means it has a zero eigenvalue, and it means it's not invertible. The determinant is zero, and the matrix is not invertible. So this is a typical situation. And for example, in quantum field theory, it would mean that the propagator of A, your means of evolving A as a function of time, or solving for A in terms of the current, doesn't exist. So the reason is very simple. Reason that the Maxwell equations are gauge invariant. Under a mu goes to a mu plus d mu epsilon. Let me call it a mu prime. Where epsilon is any scalar function on spacetime. Okay. And so if I have a solution to the Maxwell equations, I can change it by a gauge transformation, and it's still a solution because this gauge transformation does not affect f mu nu, right? F mu nu goes to f mu nu prime, which is f mu nu. So obviously, I still solve the Maxwell equations. And as I said, the current is gauge invariant. In electromagnetism. So to solve Maxwell equations, to solve the Maxwell equations uniquely, you need to pick a gauge. I.e., to fix the function epsilon. You have to make some choice as to what epsilon is. There are infinite number of choices. The one rule in life is that no one choice is good for all problems. Okay? So you've got to be flexible. You've got to say, somehow the laws of physics have this ambiguity. I'm free to resolve it. And I need to resolve it in different ways according to the context. Okay, it's very interesting. So you can fairly easily show, for any particular gauge, you can show a pathology, which is then removed by going to a different gauge. Okay. So examples. So you see you've got one gauge degree of freedom. You've got one function that is arbitrary. The gauge condition is specified by one function, which is not gauge invariant. You've got to write down something which is not gauge invariant and set it equal to something fixed, and then you will fix the single free function. So this is called Lorentz gauge. Okay, obviously it's not gauge invariant, because if d mu a mu is 0, then d mu a mu prime is d mu a mu plus d mu d nu epsilon. Well, this was 0. Okay, but this is not 0. So what you're doing is, sorry, I shouldn't have said it that way. Maybe a better way of saying it is I want to impose this condition. So imagine somebody gives me a d mu a mu which is not 0. Then what I'm going to do is do a gauge transformation, and I'll choose epsilon exactly to set this equal to 0. So if d mu a mu is not 0, we're going to choose epsilon so that d mu a mu prime equals 0. So from any given configuration of the vector potential, I can always perform a gauge transformation to set d mu a mu prime equals 0. This gives me an equation, which is d squared epsilon equals minus d mu a mu. And this can always be solved. For epsilon. One bad feature of the Lorentz gauge is a sort of nice feature of it is Lorentz invariant. Like, it's not gauge invariant, but it's Lorentz invariant. The bad feature of it is that this does not uniquely determine epsilon. You see, there is an inhomogeneous solution to this equation, but I could always add to epsilon any other harmonic function, any function satisfying the wave equation, and it will. But the solution is not unique, is still ambiguous. Because the gauge condition only fixes epsilon up to two functions satisfying d squared epsilon equals 0. So you have this, what we call residual gauge freedom. In the Lorentz gauge. So from this point of view, a better gauge is a Coulomb gauge, which is no longer Lorentz invariant. Coulomb gauge. So Coulomb gauge is div A equals 0. I'm sure this was never invented by Coulomb, so I have no idea why it's called Coulomb gauge. Okay, I guess it's, I don't know. Coulomb certainly wasn't aware of gauge invariance. But anyway, Coulomb gauge is just the spatial divergence of A being 0. And that's easy to see that this always has a unique, this completely fixes the gauge. The gauge freedom. Okay, so if I had, I can see this because div of a prime, or gradient, sorry, div of a prime is div of a plus d squared epsilon. And if I set that equal to 0, this uniquely fixes epsilon. Why? Because there are no solutions to grad squared epsilon equals 0 with epsilon going to 0 at infinity. So if I impose usual boundary conditions, which is the gauge transformation should vanish at infinity, there are no solutions to Laplace's equation in flat space, except epsilon equals 0. So Coulomb gauge is kind of nice because it completely fixes the gauge freedom, but it's ugly because it breaks Lorentz invariance. And to see that each gauge has difficulties, for example, in Coulomb gauge, it's very easy to see that the, imagine I have a spherical shell of charge. In Coulomb gauge, when you solve for the electric field, the way you do it is with the electrostatic potential. And so you solve the equation outside the sphere. And just as Newton showed, you can show that spherical symmetry implies a unique solution, which is that the scalar potential goes at 1 over r, and the electric field goes as 1 over r squared. And that doesn't matter if the shell is expanding. Okay, it's spherical symmetry forces you to the Coulomb, usual Coulomb solution for the electric field. Now, if that shell is moving at the speed of light, still true. Okay, that solution is still valid in Coulomb gauge. What you could say is, all right, let me try and do this in Lorentz gauge. And then you find Lorentz gauge. In Lorentz gauge, signals propagate at the speed of light. And it turns out this solution is completely singular in Lorentz gauge. An expanding spherical shell of charge going out at the speed of light. It cannot be described in Lorentz gauge. So that's just one example of a configuration that makes sense in one gauge but doesn't make sense in another. So now let's now go to general relativity, and we'll see exactly the same problem. So in general relativity, instead of gauge transformations, we have coordinate transformations. And we don't have one free function, epsilon, to play with. We have four, because we can change from x to x prime, which is defined by four free functions. So gr, g mu nu equals 8 pi g over c to the fourth. T mu nu. So it looks like 10 equations for 10 unknowns, G mu nu. But there are four identities. These are not really 10 independent equations. There are four identities. D mu, G mu nu equals 0. And so there are really only six independent equations. equations. You see, so in Maxwell, you could say the same thing. This equation looks like four equations for four unknowns, the A nus. Okay, but the trouble is there's one identity, which is d nu, d mu, f mu nu is minus d nu, j nu, which is zero. Because the electric current is, four-vector current is conserved, and the left-hand side is anti-symmetric, so that's a zero, too. So there exists one identity, one differential identity, So from this point of view, A mu is not completely determined for this reason. To determine all four components of A mu, you would need four equations, but you don't have four equations. You have three. In GR, you need 10 equations, but you only have six. Okay, so this is the other side of the story of gauge invariance. Gauge invariance comes along with identities which prevent you uniquely solving the equation. So so the reason for the ambiguity in the solution is gauge invariance. So if I change x mu to x prime mu, which is x mu plus epsilon mu of x, so I'm doing a small coordinate transformation, then as we already discussed, the change in the metric, small, the change in the metric is minus epsilon nu comma mu minus epsilon mu, sorry, covariant derivative nu. This is the Lie derivative. L epsilon of g mu nu. And that's easy to see because we know that g prime mu nu of x prime is dx dx prime dx dx prime of g of x. Okay, alpha beta mu nu. And so simply by working this out, and remember this is defined to be g prime mu nu of x minus g mu nu of x. This is the change in the functional form of the metric. Okay, so coordinate transformations change the metric, but in particular, they change its functional form. They change it from one function to another function. Because the equations are coordinate invariant, you're guaranteed this new function is also going to solve the Einstein equations. Okay, and so because there are four such possible invariances, the solutions of the Einstein equations are not unique. So if somebody hands you a solution of the Einstein equation, first thing you can do with it is to take the Lie derivative of it with respect to any four-vector epsilon at all, and you're guaranteed that the new metric G mu nu plus delta G mu nu will still solve the Einstein equations. So you need to choose a gauge. A gauge. And different problems require different gauges. So one choice, which is particularly useful for gravitational waves, is harmonic gauge. Which has a nice name. Harmonic gauge is specified as follows. You see, I want four equations to fix four functions, my four arbitrary epsilons. Okay, so I want to write down something which has four indices, but which is not coordinate invariant. So what quantity do you know which has four indices and is not coordinate invariant, and is very natural to write down? Okay, so I've got to get something with four indices out of G. Now, G has 10 indices. There's nothing much I can do with G apart from this. I guess I could do this. D mu G mu nu equals zero, right? I could write that down. Let's think about that. Is that a sensible gauge condition? What's that? Why not? I don't want something coordinate invariant. I just want something with four indices. Okay? You could write this down. This is, after all, you know, it's something involving first derivatives of the metric. You might feel that there's something else involving first derivatives of the metric. All right, CF, let's say, how do I get four equations out of that? I want to write down four equations involving gamma. What could I do? I could contract it with G mu nu, right? Or I could contract one up, one down. Okay, so there are various things you can write down. It turns out that harmonic gauge is this one. This is, by definition, gamma lambda with no downstairs indices. And harmonic gauge, you set this zero. Okay, so that's the definition of harmonic gauge. I just take the connection, contract it with the metric tensor. Obviously, it only affects the symmetric part of the connection. And I set this quantity to zero. That's the definition of harmonic gauge. It's particularly useful because it implies this is particularly nice because if I think about scalars, d mu, d lambda, phi. So imagine I take the Laplacian on curved space, okay, which is the covariant derivative contracted with itself, on a scalar. This will turn out to be 1 over, so in general, it's equal to this, d mu root minus g, g mu nu d nu phi. Okay, so of course, I haven't shown you the intermediate steps, but if I write this as, let me write it as follows. Let me put this one up and this one down. This I can write as, you see, the covariant derivative on a scalar is an ordinary derivative. And then I take the covariant derivative with the index up on a downstairs index. So I'm going to get, in fact, let me write it this way, g mu lambda. So this is d, g mu nu, and then d mu. D lambda phi. This covariant derivative is just d lambda phi. There's no connection if you have no indices. Minus gamma mu lambda alpha d alpha phi. And so you can see that this is equal to well, that's what it is. I've got the indices wrong, haven't I? That should be lambda. That should be lambda. D mu should be here. This is lambda. Yeah, that's correct now. Okay. So actually, we won't need this. We'll do this formula later. Okay. But you can immediately see that the connection term is exactly this gamma, right? So this is equal to g mu d lambda phi minus gamma alpha d alpha phi. Okay, so in harmonic gauge, this is zero. So harmonic gauge is sort of nice in that the connection disappears from any from the scalar Laplacian, i.e., connection disappears from the scalar Laplacian. So it's common to write harmonic gauge in this way, to write harmonic gauge as box x mu equals 0, okay, where box is equal to d mu d mu. And scalar. You see, covariant derivatives depend on what they're operating on. But the scalar form of the covariant derivative is the one I used here. And this is the scalar box. So this, by definition, is box phi. And so when you write this equation down, you see if I use the scalar box on the coordinates themselves, the first term is 0 because two derivatives on the coordinates give 0. And the second term is 0 because gamma is 0. So this is a little bit of a strange equation, okay? Why? Because x isn't a vector, right? The coordinates are not vectors. Only dx is a vector. The change in the coordinate is a vector, but the vector, the coordinate itself is not a vector. So that's why this is not gauge invariant. Okay, but anyway, it's a kind of neat way of writing down what harmonic gauge is. This turns out, just as the Lorentz gauge is good for radiation problems in electrodynamics, the harmonic gauge is good for radiation problems in GR. And so next time we will study gravitational waves and use this harmonic gauge to, just as we would use the Lorentz gauge in electrodynamics, to identify what are the waves, whether they're transverse or longitudinal or whatever. So gravitational waves are very exciting right now because the next 5 years are going to see the opening of the gravitational wave window on the universe for the first time. We've never actually detected a gravitational wave. Okay, we know they exist. We can infer that from various astrophysical observations. in fact, a Nobel Prize has been awarded for seeing the binary pulsar speeding up due to emitting gravitational waves, exactly as predicted by GR. But we've never really detected a gravitational wave. So that's about to change. There is the LIGO observatory and partner observatories. And it is strongly expected that within the next 5 years, we'll see the first signals of gravitational waves emitted by binary black holes or black hole neutron stars or neutron star as they orbit around each other. And then just like a moving electric charges radiate radio waves or light, this radiates gravitational waves. So this is tremendously exciting, and so I'll talk about gravitational waves next time. Yeah.
When you talk about the gauge symmetry of the relativity, you said that the diffeomorphisms can be understood as some kind of gauge symmetry.
Yes.
So if you only take the infinitesimal.
Yes. Yes.
The full group is too big, right?
Too big. Too big, and yeah, impossible to understand. Yeah, there's a parallel, but in electrodynamics, we're of course just working in Minkowski spacetime. We don't change the spacetime coordinates at all. All we do is this gauge transformation. All right, one's arbitrary scalar function. So that's what we have in electrodynamics. One way of thinking about this, in fact, this was quite a fruitful way, is if you imagine taking Einstein gravity in 5 dimensions instead of 4, where the 5th dimension has a coordinate x5, then it turns out this epsilon is precisely if you change the 5th coordinate, if you say x5 goes to x5 plus delta x5 of x, of the other 4 coordinates, that turns out to be precisely this gauge transformation of the vector potential. So there is a relationship, but I think it's still not really understood. There's some analogy. Yeah. So Kaluza-Klein theory, I take gravity in 5 dimensions, and then I show that the Einstein equations, if I insist, so you take gravity in 5 dimensions, you take a 5x5 metric, and you write out its components, and I probably won't get this right, but it's something like this. It's a 5x5 matrix, these 4, and then there is G55. If I insist that all of these functions are functions only of the 4 coordinates, okay, just ignore the 5th coordinate, then it turns out the 5D Einstein equations equal the 4D Einstein equations with electromagnetism for free. Okay, and the coordinate invariance of the 5-dimensional Einstein equations gives rise to the gauge invariance of the Maxwell equations. Okay, so it's a very beautiful construction realized in the 1920s. People still haven't really made it work. The reason is, if you really believe in this 5th dimension, why doesn't it evolve? Why doesn't it change in size? In fact, this G55 turns out to be a 4-dimensional scalar. You see, G55 will not change under 4D coordinate transformations at all. So this is a scalar. It's called a dilaton. It exists in string theory and M theory, essentially for this reason. That's why you get a dilaton, because these theories map to higher dimensional theories in a way very much like this. So it's still very mysterious. Exactly what is a gauge transformation? Is it a coordinate transformation in another dimension? Should I take it at face value just as a free function? Why is it there? Why are the laws of physics invariant under gauge transformations? Yeah. Well, it didn't work in 4, so it's not going to work in 5. You know, it was Einstein's worst idea, so don't go there. No, it doesn't work in phi. So true, it doesn't. I guarantee you, it doesn't work in 5. So when you do it in 5D, what you discover, if you just do what you said, you discover that I have a new scalar field in 4D, and it obeys an equation like this, where this is the 5-dimensional cosmological constant, with a potential of some number times phi. That's what you get. The trouble is, this scalar field lives in a potential, it's just going to roll downhill. And it rolls downhill forever, it keeps changing, which is telling you the fifth dimension is blowing up. So this is a big problem with these high-dimensional theories, is that the extra dimensions won't stay put. Okay, they're going to go singular, they're going to blow up. Gravity doesn't like to be static. Okay, so now people get around this by saying, okay, let's add another dimension, and we'll go to 6 dimensions. Okay. Actually, 6 dimensions is very, very interesting for other reasons, but because of electromagnetic duality. But you go to 6 dimensions, and now you say your extra dimensions are a sphere, a 2-sphere. In that case, you can put a magnetic flux on this 2-sphere, and that stabilizes it against squishing down. And so there are all kinds of people making models of how to stabilize this dimension. You can do it in some cases. It's never very compelling. I mean, basically, you have to add a pile of junk in order to make it work. And then you added so much junk, you spoiled the beauty of the whole idea. That's the situation. And you know, this attempt has led to the multiverse problem, that if you take string theory, there are at least 10 to the power 500 different ways to compactify it, each one of which with a thousands of free parameters and fields and garbage, okay? And it's been a catastrophe. So, you know, it could be the way nature works, but I would say all the evidence is against, because the universe is damn simple. And if you have to invent some gigantic machine with 1,000 knobs you have to dial to fit what we see, I think somehow we're missing the point. So it's very fundamental. So the upshot is, I think we still don't understand where gauge invariance arises from. Coordinate invariance, we somehow do intuitively understand. We're saying GR is about geometry, the coordinates shouldn't matter, right? So there we have a very clear understanding why coordinate invariance should be true, because we have a geometrical space-time. But even that, you see, you can question that, because do you really believe there's a geometrical space-time? In quantum gravity, it seems ridiculous, because you have to have fluctuating space-time, and we must have more than one space-time existing at once. And the universe is not following a single space-time if you believe in quantum gravity. So from that point of view, the geometry doesn't make any sense. So I would say we're still really stuck on understanding why these gauge invariances arise. They're absolutely essential. Without gauge invariance, we are dead. In fact, Weinberg has a very nice discussion in his book about this. And his point of view is, you know, let's just step back and imagine I'm in Minkowski space, and all I want to do is describe gravitational waves. And I'm going to treat them as a spin 2 particle, elementary particle, traveling in Minkowski space. And I want to write down a consistent S matrix for scattering spin 2 particles off each other. Then what he shows is the only way you can do that is if you have gauge invariance. Okay? If you write down a spin equation for a spin 2 particle, it generally has 5 solutions for propagating waves. And you only want 2. You want the spin 2, the particle. You know, so a spin 2 particle in quantum mechanics has 5, if you specify the total spin, and you then say, where is JZ? You know, it's 2, 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2. So in quantum mechanics, saying something has total spin 2 generally gives you 5 quantum states. That's what happens with a spin 2 particle in GR, unless there's a gauge invariance. The gauge invariance magically gets rid of the 1, 0, minus 1, leaving you only with the plus 2 and the minus 2. And nobody's been able to write down a consistent theory of a spin 2 particle without imposing gauge invariance. So from this point of view, you would say the fundamental idea is there are spin 2 particles in nature. There are massless spin 2 particles, have two helicities, plus 2 and minus 2. That forces us to gauge invariance. When we try to interpret that gauge invariance, it turns out it's coordinate invariance. So Weinberg has the absolutely opposite point of view, that coordinate invariance is just as something that arises as a consequence of describing spin 2 particles with only two states. Yes, there are various attempts to describe massive spin 2 particles. The graviton is a massless spin 2 particle. So Weinberg is saying, for massless spin 2 particles, I need gauge invariance, I need coordinate invariance. If I do massive spin 2 particles, A, there's no observational evidence for them, and plenty against. A lot of people here spend a lot of time trying to write down field equations for massive spin 2 particles. I don't think they have really succeeded. When you write down nonlinear equations, they tend to have horrible instabilities and wild behavior. So I don't think there's a theorem preventing it, but in 30 years of searching, there's no really good equation for a massive spin 2 particle. Yeah.
In Maxwell theory, we can get away without introducing A at all and just solve directly for the fields, right?
Say again, we can
get away. In Maxwell theory, we don't really need the potential. We can just get away with solving for the fields.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, yeah. The E and the B. That's right.
Yeah,
so in Maxwell's theory, yeah, in Maxwell's theory, you have that option of just never talking about A, just talk about F. The trouble is you can't write an action principle without introducing the A mu. Okay? There are various action principles. I think you've done the action. Have you done the action? So there is this action minus 1/4 F mu nu, F mu nu. Right? But where I say that F mu nu is this guy, and I vary with respect to A. Okay? If I treated F as the dynamical degree of freedom, the equations of motion I would get is that F mu nu is 0, okay, which wouldn't be very good. Pardon? It's the same thing in GR. In electrodynamics, we have helicity plus 1 and minus. One, yeah, no, it wouldn't work with F mu nu. There is an alternative action called the first order action, which is roughly speaking this. Let me see, how does it? Let me just try and remember. So there's an alternative action, which is this, plus some constant times F mu nu. F mu nu. You can write this down as an action, where I regard F as a free function and A as a free function. And then if I vary A, and then I guess I'd have the coupling to the current. So you see, if I vary with respect to A, I'm going to get the Maxwell equation for F. And if I vary with respect to F, I'm going to get that F is the antisymmetric derivative of A. So this is another action, but it still involves A. So the trouble is we don't seem able to write down actions except in terms of things which are not gauge invariant. And then we vary these non-gauge invariant things, and we get gauge invariant equations of motion. All right, so we're thwarted at every step. We can't describe nature as it actually is. Just unable to do that. And therefore, all this issue of gauge invariance and so on arises. And it seems to be essential, but we don't really understand it. Okay, so I shall see you tomorrow morning.